where Wilton comes first for news and talk. The Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
And welcome back to the show. The Stanford Advocate did a marvelous interview with our next guest, David Tunick, who is apparently a very accomplished, self-sufficient man with a dream of sailing solo, who landed safely back in Stanford not too long ago and is living to tell us the tale. Hello, David Tunick, and welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much. May I call you by your first name?
Oh, of course. Only. Call me Lisa, please.
Okay. So, thank you, Lisa.
So, David, David, how old are you? Let's get some of the stats here. How old are you?
I'm 78 years old, be 79 in November.
So, and that's okay. That's not a young age. It's not old, but it's more old than it is young. You're 78 years old. And did you just sail solo from Madrid back to Connecticut? Did you do that by yourself?
I sailed from the northwest corner of Spain up near Finisterre, near Santiago de Compostela, back to Stanford alone. Yes, I did that. That had been a plan and a promise to myself when I sailed over alone from Stanford to England in 2001, thinking I'd only be over there for a year or two, and then it turned out to be 22 years. I loved having the boat in Northern Europe, particularly Scandinavia.
And you stayed and lived there for those 20 years, or you left the boat and came back here?
No, I didn't. I luckily have the kind of a job. I'm an art dealer in New York. I specialize in works of art on paper, from old masters to classic modern. And I didn't realize when I went into the art business that it's seasonal, Lisa. And that means that in the summer, curators, museum directors go away, collectors, by and large, go away. And that has allowed for a lifetime of sailing in the summer. I lived on my boat two and a half months a year in Europe, would only come back on a need-to basis, and then always return. So usually it was two and a half months on board the boat in Northern Europe.
I see. And then you would fly back here and have your life back here and then get back to your boat?
Yes, and I would visit one time during the winter to do jobs and check up on progress and so forth. There's always maintenance to do on a boat, and there are always things to renew on a boat.
Have you been a sailor your whole life?
No, but it's in my genes in a way, because my father and my four great bachelor uncles all loved being on the water. They had a power boat that they owned together, and there was nothing I'd rather do on a weekend than in Greenwich go out from Indian Harbor out to Island Beach, and we'd anchor and fish. And so I loved floating around on a boat, and as soon as I was able to, I bought a sailboat. I was introduced to sailing at a young age, but I didn't really take it up. That was a yacht club route. We didn't belong to any yacht clubs in those years. And I took it up in my 20s. I bought a boat with a partner for $300 because I couldn't afford one myself. And I sailed it. It was a small open boat, and I'd sail it here out of Greenwich over to Oyster Bay and so on with a sleeping bag. And then later on, I bought myself a boat before I was 35, a 40-foot boat, and then eventually the 55-foot boat that I own now that is 55 years old itself, and I've owned it nearly 40 years. And so that I took voyaging. I sailed down to Bermuda several times, back and forth to the Caribbean six times, sometimes alone to Bermuda, often up to Maine alone. And so it's something that I've always loved doing. Nothing I'd rather do than be floating around on a boat.
We're chatting with David Tunick. So tell me about, what is the pull for you, and why so many voyages by yourself?
What is the goal for me? Was that your question?
No, the pull. What's the attraction?
In other words, attraction.
Yeah.
I like the self-reliance. I like the challenges. I wasn't brought up in a household in which I learned how to fix things. It just was not my father's interest nor skill. And at Rogers School in Stanford, we had a job class. That's what it was called. And that was very valuable, and I might have been the worst student in that class. And so I was always determined to learn how to handle breakdowns of various sorts, how to fix things, how to make things. Uh-huh. And so that certainly is a part of it, the self-reliance and the challenge. And that's why I do. The other thing is about sailing alone, Lisa, is that you don't have to worry about someone else. I'm very involved in safety as a safety instructor and at a couple of the yacht clubs I belong to as a safety instructor. And when I'm alone, I only have myself to worry about. I generally know when I make mistakes, and I make a lot of them. I'm not a great sailor, but I'm confident in myself, and I'm confident in my boat. Very important to have confidence in your boat. And so I like being out there alone. I remember when I decided to become a solo sailor, I had a crew lined up to sail down to Bermuda one time, four or five friends. One guy calls me up and he says, I can't go. This was 3 days before departure. He said, Abby, his wife, he said, wants me to go up to Lake Winnipesaukee for a family picnic for 4th of July. And so I said, you know what, from now on, I'm just going to do this myself. I can do it.
Okay.
And so I have quite a lot since then. I practice it every summer, across the North Sea a few times, and other such passages.
We're chatting with David Tunick, who just got back from Spain and made it by himself in a 55-foot sailboat. Tell us a little bit, the sailboat. Are you mostly sailing? Do you have a backup motor in case there's no wind? Tell me about the navigation piece.
The reason I'm going ha-ha is because my engine quit on me. When I still had thousands of miles to go. And in fact, I was trapped in the Azores High. I put into Horta in the Azores. The Azores are about 1,000 miles due west of Portugal. And I had already had trouble on the boat with the steering system. It got stuck, and I was suddenly steering sharply to the northwest, I mean, towards Greenland instead of south.
Uh-oh.
My original route that I had planned, Lisa, was down to the Canary Islands, about 1,000 miles south of the northwest coast of Spain. Then I was going to hang a right, go in the trade winds, the traditional trade wind route, over towards the Caribbean. And then once the southwesterlies kicked in, you know, in this part of the world, our prevailing wind is southwesterly, and that's true all up and down the coast. And so once the southwesterlies kicked in, the plan was to arc up, go past Bermuda, but not that close to it, and then on into Long Island Sound. That would have been about 4,250 miles altogether, nautical miles. Nautical mile is 1.1, 10% more than a regular statute mile. But I was hoping for a window to go via the Azores. And that in the end is what I did. Once I got that steering straightened out again and I was able to turn around, I was 100 miles off course, hundreds of miles, and I went towards the Azores. But I had trouble with my generator and my autopilots, and so I thought I'll put into Horta, repair some of these things, and then take off again. And then going into Horta, we almost shipwrecked. By we, I mean the boat, Night Watch, and I. Night Watch, by the way, is a double reference. Because you take a watch at night on a boat. And in art, I'm very involved with Rembrandt, for example, and it's the name of the best-known Rembrandt painting, which is in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. Anyway, put into Horta, almost shipwrecked, because I got in there. It was blowing 25 or 30, and the harbor was packed because the weather was so harsh outside. And my steering got stuck again, and I got deeply into the harbor trying to weave among these boats. I had about 5% steerage, port and starboard, to right and left, or to left and right. And I was able to turn it around when I was within, I don't know, 100, 200 yards, I don't want to exaggerate it, of shipwrecking right in town against a stone wall and a road.
Oh, my goodness.
I managed to turn the boat around. At that point, the engine was still working, and by quick forward and reverse, I was able to weave back out, and I anchored right in the mouth of the harbor. And that was also very perilous because these storm winds were blowing in with big waves. The anchor has a chain, and it was bucking like a bronco. So every time it went up, the bow went way up, that chain just snapped like an iron bar. And I was afraid, you know, weakest link. I was afraid of a link breaking or the anchor ripping off or ripping something off the boat. At any rate, the next morning, I contacted Harbor Authority. There was something that snapped and broke. And I called the Harbor Authority in Horta in the Azores, and I said, it'd be very nice if you could help me because I don't have steerage, and I'm going to shipwreck. I could go back into a town. The wall is only 100 yards behind me. So I almost shipwrecked in Horta twice, and they took me in the ferry terminal, which was very nice. And from there, when I left to get back to your question, so roundabout, I take off towards Bermuda, not intending to go in, but the engine quits about, I don't know, 500 miles out, and I still have about something like 1,500 miles to go, even to Bermuda.
Wow.
And so the Azores High, which is in the center, really, of the North Atlantic, if you think of the North Atlantic as a big clock, the wind and currents go around like, you know, the minute hand. They whip around. The center is very calm. But that Azores High shifts depending upon both the season and what the weather is doing.
What do you mean by the high, David Tunick? What is the high? What do you mean?
The Azores High is a very calm area in the middle of the ocean that is usually somewhere in the vicinity of the Azores.
Okay.
And it has almost no wind or no wind. And so the engine quit. I got trapped in there.
Oh.
And the Azores High kept extending. It extended about 2,000 miles.
Wow.
All the way from Azores down to Bermuda. So I got stuck for, I don't know, it all added up to 2 weeks. And the heat was intense. The jellyfish were swimming faster than the boat was going. I was having trouble with the generator. I went dark a couple of nights, which means, you know, nothing on. I was trying to preserve battery power while I was working on fixing the generator, which I eventually was able to do. But the engine never came back. A little breeze came up, and finally I was able – it took me 4 weeks to get to Bermuda from the Azores, what should have been 2 weeks.
Wow.
I got to Bermuda at night about 2 in the morning in the dark, went for a spot where I had arranged for a small towboat to come out. That took me into the customs dock. And by that time, the autopilots had quit. I had even put in a new autopilot plus a backup autopilot because you're not at the helm when you're on a trip like this, or you're rarely at the helm, and you depend on your autopilots. Well, the autopilots went down, and so I was able to rig loose lines to the wheel, to the helm, and adjust the sails so that I was able to steer straight as an arrow except when the wind changed. And I did that for thousands of miles with line on the helm. So, and the bilge pumps also at one stage all failed until I have about 6 of them aboard. They all failed. And I replaced the primary one in Bermuda, and that worked all the way back. But this cascade of equipment failures, in all my 40-plus years of sailing offshore, I never experienced anything like it. It was just bad luck and presented more challenges, but we managed to get through it. Except on the way from Bermuda got the engine going, not the autopilots. And on the way back up, you know, it's really short from Bermuda up here to Long Island Sound. It's only 4 to 6 days, depending on your boat. An asynchronous wave, sometimes they're called rogue waves. They're out of rhythm with the other waves. Struck the boat, smashed against the boat, and it threw me. I was below from the port side to the starboard side, and I broke a couple ribs. I didn't know it at the time.
Oh.
But I lost use of my left arm for the rest of the trip.
Oh, David!
Now it's come back, you know, ribs heal. They heal by themselves. It takes about 6 weeks, 8 weeks, something like that, and it's not a big deal. And I lost 20 pounds on the trip, which I ate all my meals. I was fully nourished. I'd always take more than 2 to 3 times the provisions I'll need. But the heat was so intense that I didn't, in the Azores High when it was calm, that I didn't go up on deck during the day. I went up on deck if I had to make sail changes or fix anything, and I always like checking everything. I'd go up around dawn and same thing at dusk, and I slept in the cockpit a couple times. But mostly I slept below. But below is also like an inferno during the calm because it's a metal boat. It's an aluminum hull.
Oh, boy.
Teak, and the
so it's like an oven.
Also.
So it's like an oven.
It was like an oven. But I knew the whole time, you know, there's no rescue out there, you know, when you're beyond a few hundred miles. Helicopters can't get you, and I would never call rescue from a large ship. You go out there alone, you are really on your
you are
on your own. And I always knew that in the end, a breeze would come up. I would emerge from that Azores High, and I'd end up somewhere sometime. That's the great thing about a sailing boat. You can go just about anywhere you want. You don't need an engine. And indeed, I didn't have one for at least half or more of the trip, Lisa.
So what I'm hearing, what an adventure, but what I'm hearing is that a lot of times things take longer than you imagine. How do you have enough fresh water, for example? Are you having any kind of desalinizing along the way if you run out of fresh water? What do you do?
No, I've never wanted a desalinator aboard. That's another level of complexity. And I carry plenty of water, and I drink water all day long, every day. I carry 200 gallons of water, you know, about 800 liters, and that's plenty for one person. That's another beauty of sailing alone. You don't have to provision as much as
right.
you do for a crew. I only carry about 3 days of fuel, and then I carry some extra fuel and jerry jugs that would give me another day or so, day and a half. But you want to conserve your fuel, or I did anyway, for charging and for getting out of a calm. So it didn't. I arrived with almost as much fuel as I left. I used very little fuel, in fact, on the crossing.
When we're chatting with David Tunick, this is really fascinating. Did you ever? I mean, you talk about that one wave that whipped you and broke your rib. Was your boat ever in danger of tipping? In other words, did you ever find yourself in a storm or a squall where, you know, you might have just capsized over?
Yeah, my first few days, it looked like I had a good weather window for leaving. And I had hired a weather router, which all the commercial ships have and many of us out there who are offshore crossing oceans. And we agreed, he and I agreed, it was a good weather window for shooting straight out towards the Azores when I finally took off. Rather than going south, we knew that the winds were going to be robust, but we did not foresee that there were going to be gales. And so I had gales from the first or second night, gales, which means, you know, more than 32 knots. I had them up 35 knots plus. And so you are really cracking along. The boat is heeled way over, but it's not what we call tipping. I never was in any danger of the boat overturning. I have an old boat, a full keel. It weighs 22 ton, and there's no boat maybe other than, I don't know, the Queen Mary II I'd feel safer on in the ocean than my boat. And so when we were in those gales the first 2 days, that lasted for 2 days, the steering was also stuck, and that's when I was going in the wrong direction. All I could really do was kind of, you know, get comfortable on the leeward side, the downward side in my berth, and watch it go by and go and have a look once in a while to see if there was traffic around. And otherwise, I slept fine. I ate fine. And the boat is screaming along in the screaming weather, and I had every confidence that nothing would break. I mean, something's always going to break on a boat, and you hope that it doesn't happen
did
in a situation
feel,
like
did
the
Did you feel, David Tunick, did you feel very alive? Is that part of what goes on when you're on these journeys and you're testing yourself constantly against nature? Do you have a heightened sense of life?
There, Lisa. I love the majesty of the Milky Way at night. I mean, it never is as bright as when you are in mid-ocean with no other light. I mean, it just really blows me away. I love being out there at the bow, watching the dolphins playing around the bow, you know, with the bow wave. And so I guess that is feeling very alive. Let me put it this way. I never felt close to the opposite of being alive. I never felt imperiled at all on this passage. And it really fulfilled my longtime plan to sail back the same way I'd gone over, and that is alone, except coming back is more difficult and longer than sailing from the United States to Europe, because there you're going with the Gulf Stream and,
yes,
and with the wind.
It helps.
And you're not on the on the return.
Well, David Tunick, it's really I'm just happy that you came on. I'm so happy to have heard your story and all your obstacles. Isn't it Nietzsche who said that which does not kill us makes us stronger? You got to be one strong guy. You got to be
one other thing if I have another minute, if that's
sure.
Okay.
Sure.
I do find it extremely exciting and liberating to be sailing alone out there. And I always think about what Sartre said. He said, if you don't like being alone, you're in the wrong company.
Mm.
So I've always enjoyed it. I enjoy all of it. I love having guests aboard. I love cruising in company. And I love being here in Long Island Sound and sailing out of Stamford and the whole coast of New England and Cape Cod and the islands and Nova Scotia. And I think that's what I'll do for the next couple of years and then decide after that going forward. I want to get my grandchildren aboard. They're 2 to 6 and get them going in this sport that has so enriched my life.
Well, you know what, David, if you ever want any completely inexperienced company, I'll try not to be a burden. I would love to go sailing with you one day.
I'm being serious. You call me. I'd be glad to take you out. Right now, I've been working on the boat's electrical system every day since coming back because, in fact, the most dangerous situation I had was in flat, placid, beautiful Long Island Sound the last 50, 60 miles. My voltages were spiking. And I was in danger of the batteries catching fire. And so I put some of my essential things in the cockpit in case I needed to abandon ship right here in Long Island Sound. That was kind of extraordinary and ironic to me.
Wow. All right, David. Well, we'll stay in touch. You're definitely an inspiring guy. I loved talking with you today. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Wonderful talking with you, Lisa. Bye.
Bye. David Tunick on the Lisa Wexler Show, A Life of Adventure. We'll be right back.